Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a conversation with Benjamin L. Crump, attorney for the families of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and others whose sons were killed by police. I spoke with Crump on stage at the Justice on Trial Film Festival, an event held by a New Way of Life Reentry Project on September 17th, 2017. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Trump has approved a disaster declaration for Puerto Rico as tens of thousands of residents began to slowly assess the damage from Hurricane Maria, which ravaged the island over the past hours and days. Rescue crews have begun to fan out across the island where power has been knocked out. The extent of the damage is unknown, given that dozens of municipalities remained isolated and without communication after Maria hit the island Wednesday morning as a Category 4 storm with 155 mile-per-hour winds, the strongest hurricane to hit Puerto Rico in over 80 years. Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosselló told CNN the storm has passed, but the danger isn't over.
People might have a sense of that they have gone through the worst part of it. But as we know with hurricanes, it's the flooding, it's the heavy rains that tend to be the number one cause of death.
Maria has caused at least 10 deaths across the Caribbean, including 7 in the hard-hit island of Dominica and 2 in the French Caribbean territory of Guadeloupe. Maria weakened to a Category 2 storm later in the day, but re-strengthened to Category 3 status early today with winds at 115 miles per hour. It was centered about 70 miles north of the Dominican Republic. Rescuers are racing against the clock to reach survivors trapped under the rubble of a school in Mexico City, which collapsed during Tuesday's earthquake. One is a 12-year-old girl who was believed to be sheltering under a table, but rescuers say they don't know how to reach her. At least 21 children and 5 adults died as the school collapsed. The school was one of dozens of buildings toppled by the quake. More than 200 people are known to have died. President Enrique Peña Nieto has declared 3 days of mourning for the victims. It's the second earthquake to hit Mexico this month and the most deadly since a quake centered near Mexico City killed thousands in 1985. The Securities and Exchange Commission said Wednesday that a cyber breach of a filing system it uses may have provided the basis for some illegal trading in 2016. In a statement posted on the SEC website, Chairman Jay Clayton said a review of the agency's cybersecurity risk profile determined that the previously detected incident was caused by a software vulnerability in its Edgar filing system. The statement said the software was patched quickly after the hack was uncovered in 2016, although the possibility that some may have used it to make illegal profits was only discovered last month. The SEC revelation comes as Americans continue to grapple with the repercussions of a massive, months-long hack of Equifax, a credit reporting agency, which exposed highly sensitive personal information of 143 million people. California's Attorney General has sued the Trump administration over its plan to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Attorney General Javier Becerra filed the suit Wednesday. It makes arguments similar to those in a lawsuit filed by advocacy groups last week, arguing the federal government is overstepping its authority by waiving environmental reviews and other laws. Both lawsuits aim to stop the design, planning, and construction of the wall. The Trump administration recently waived environmental reviews on a 15-mile stretch in San Diego, where wall prototypes will be constructed. The cities of San Francisco and Oakland are filing separate lawsuits against some of the world's biggest oil companies for their contributions to climate change. The cities are seeking compensation for the billions they'll have to spend dealing with the effects of sea level rise and other effects of climate change. The companies say climate change should be fought on the global level, and the suits are unhelpful. Christopher Martinez reports.
The cities of San Francisco and Oakland have filed suit against the biggest oil companies under California's public nuisance laws.
The rubber's hitting the road now as we speak.
Dennis Herrera is San Francisco city attorney.
It's pretty clear that a substantial contributor to a public nuisance under state law is liable joint and severally for that wrong, and that they can be required to pay into an abatement fund to remedy the nuisance.
They name five defendants: Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, BP, and Royal Dutch Shell. They say the companies knew the risks of climate change, but covered them up. Barbara Parker is Oakland's city attorney.
Their own scientific studies put them on notice, yet they shamelessly engaged in a campaign of deception, denial, to protect their market for fossil fuels.
In Oakland, climate change's effects, such as sea level rise, threaten the city's downtown. The lawsuits will move forward in state superior courts in San Francisco and Oakland. Reporting from San Francisco, I'm Christopher Martinez.
A California judge says the state attorney general's description of a ballot initiative to repeal the recently approved gas tax increase is misleading. A county superior court judge, Timothy Frawley, issued a tentative ruling Tuesday, saying he's likely to order Democratic Attorney General Javier Becerra to rewrite the ballot title and summary. Republican Assemblyman Travis Allen, a candidate for governor, is backing the repeal initiative and brought the suit. Frawley will hear arguments on the title Friday. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. First, I want to express distress and sympathy at the devastation of the earthquake in Mexico and Hurricane Maria that devastated the Caribbean islands of Dominica, St. Croix, and Puerto Rico. Our hearts go out to all those who lost loved ones and otherwise were impacted. We have posted information on our social media sites for those who want to assist those hard hit in the Caribbean region by both Hurricanes Irma and Maria. And once you receive similar information on aid for Mexico, we will also post those on our social media. Today, we're bringing you a special conversation with Benjamin L. Crump, the attorney who represented the families of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and others whose children were killed by police. Benjamin Crump is one of the National Trial Lawyers' Top 100 Lawyers and Ebony Magazine's Power 100 Most Influential African Americans. He's received the NAACP Thurgood Marshall Award, the SCLC Martin Luther King Servant Leader Award, and the National Urban League's Whitney Young Award. I was in conversation with Benjamin Crump in one of the plenary sessions at the 2017 Justice on Trial Film Festival, an event organized by a New Way of Life Reentry Project. Let's go now to that conversation. I wanted to start out by you sharing with us, getting from what I call there to here.
Yes, ma'am.
Lumberton, North Carolina.
Country boy.
That right? Country boy.
Yes, ma'am.
Nine sisters and brothers. Got to find out how many of them boys and girls. Raised by your grandma, then moved from North Carolina to Florida.
Yes, ma'am.
Want to find out how that happened, about the move, just a little bit about your early life. Then I'm going to want to find out what inspired you to become a lawyer, and it, you know, just in terms of your family, who were the people that really inspired you?
I was born in Lumberton, North Carolina, a country boy.
There we go.
And no matter what, I'm still a country lawyer because that people believe country lawyers. They don't believe those city slickers in courtrooms. But I was the oldest son. My mother had three children, my two little brothers, and then my biological father had three children, and then my stepfather had three children, so it was 10 in all, and I was the oldest, and we grew up in the projects of North Carolina. My mother worked two jobs, so my grandmother, Mitty Cardell, ended up doing the most rearing of my formidable years, because my mother was always working at the factory or working at the hotel, doing laundry,
thank you.
And so to me is the most intelligent person I've ever met on this earth. Minnie Carlisle had that common sense. And even when I went to college, I would call and ask my grandmother questions when you were confused about things. And I remember this. We were very pious. I grew up in the church because, you know, I know I'm not the only one who had a grandmother who kept you in church, and we were we were Pentecostal, and so all day Sunday, man, we never got to see the Dallas Cowboys on Sunday. We just be upset when we get out. But my grandmother, when we were in college, and Chris went to Florida State University with me, I never forget, and Shaka, we were at the Theory and Dynamics of Racism and Oppression class, Dr. Bill Jones. And Dr. Jones said that this is documented in American jurisprudence, that they said blacks were not allowed to be Christians initially. When we came to America, they said we were damned by nature and that we could not be Christians. And they said they only changed that way of thinking when they said, hold on, they would be better slaves if we made them Christians, and said it was going to be better when you left this earth, but you're going to have hell here. And so, you know, this young 18-year-old, I was all confused because Dr. Jones was talking about these theory and dynamics of oppression. And he was teaching that they would always use religion to oppress people. And my grandmother, who, you know, I was raised up in church, and I called my Minnie, and I said, my Minnie, you know, they said, if people in Africa who don't know anything about Jesus Christ and they don't accept them as their Savior, that they damned and they're going to hell. And I just, and the professor had said he had to go through his journey, because when he learned this, he started to say, this isn't right. Just because these people don't know about Jesus Christ, our people from Africa, they go to hell. And I said, my man, I just don't understand that. I'm kind of confused about it. And my grandmother, sixth grade education, she thought for a second and she said, well, baby, it's real simple. You're gonna hear a lot of things where people will argue over religion and debate religion. She said, it's either you believe or you don't. And I choose to believe. It gives me a lot of peace in my life. You determine what you want to do. And I can't even say anything. You know, my mother broke it down. Either you choose to believe or you don't. And that's the kind of wisdom. When I go in courtrooms and I fight and everything, I always have my mother in my ear telling me common sense things. And so,
kind of like a touchstone
to you. Yes, ma'am. She's my guiding angel no matter what. And you know that old thing Spike Lee say, always do the right thing. And I never forget talking to Spike Lee. I said, he was saying, when we were doing Trayvon, he said, people would always say, what's the right thing? What's the right thing? And Spike said, hell, I told them everybody knew what the right thing to do in their heart. The question is, are they going to do it? In every situation, you know the right thing to do. Think about all these little black and brown people being killed in America and how we intellectually justify over and over again this legalized genocide of people of color by those who are supposed to protect and serve us. And so we know what the right thing is to do as officers of the court, as lawyers. We know what the right thing is to do, but people literally, like the Stokely verdict in St. Louis 2 days ago, how that judge went out of his way to intellectually justify the killing of this this man by this police. It was outright murder when you think about it. And Chris and I were debating it, and I was giving an interview for Associated Press, and I said, you know, he wrote a 30-page order justifying the killing of this black man who he said, and it's on audio recording, I'm going to kill this MF. That's what he said. That's on the recording. And then, Paul, he goes, they chase him, and they shoot, and they kill him. It's like 8 bullets in the car. And then, it's on video, he goes back to his police car, and you see him doing something, and they see a bag in the car based on the dash cam and the cameras in the car, Susan. And then he goes back to the car where the man is dead, and all of a sudden the gun is there. And he said he didn't plant evidence. But what was crazy to me is what the judge put in that order, how he said he didn't think a gun would fit in that bag, so the state hasn't proved that he planted evidence and that this wasn't self-defense. But he wrote 30 pages, 30 pages. And what you have to think, Ricky, is when they have to write 30 pages for something that could have been one page, you know they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes. And we have to stand up and reject that stuff when we see it. We have to.
And folks, on the third day, in St. Louis, you know, one of the reasons I asked about your early life is, you know, a lot of times young folks, they look at someone like you, and they look at their own situation, right? And figure out, can I really do this? Can I be like Benjamin Crow? How do I go about it? But also, I like to ask people about what inspires them. What is the touchstone? Because a lot of times, that's part of what keeps us honest. Because especially for someone like you, God math on you clearly, right? You're a lawyer, and now you know why you became a lawyer. Why you're a successful lawyer. And it's very, very easy for somebody like that to get picked off. And if he didn't have his grandma's voice in his head, telling him, oh, no, you know right from wrong, don't go there. And, you know, I think that's important to establish. But I want to get into a little bit about some of the legal grounds. Because I know some people have the idea, some lawyers, some of whom I've met, that cases are fought and won solely by what goes on in the courtroom. And they don't really pay attention to the movement on the outside. They don't think that what is happening on the street or people's response on the street has any impact whatsoever on what goes on inside the courtroom. I wanted to get your view on that, because part of that is looking at what is the role of history. What is the role of context? What is the role of the history of these institutions in terms of what happens inside the courtroom, but also finding that balance between the courtroom and the street, the legal process and the community? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I want to answer it in two ways, if I could. I'm working on a book called Open Season, The Legalization of Discrimination, and it truly is about how from the history of the founding of this country until now, how the courts and the legislatures have found ways to intellectually justify discrimination and oppression, a lot like in your book, Susan, especially to people who look like many of you in this room, based solely on race. And it's one of those dynamics that we have to talk about, because they never want to talk about race in the court. They always try to downplay it and act like it don't exist. But when you think about the founding of America, and they talked about the 3/5 compromise, you know, anytime you hear the 10th Amendment, that's just a dog whistle for discrimination when they start talking about the state's rights. All that really means is we're going to discriminate. I mean, every instance when they bring up the 10th Amendment with Donald Trump and Jefferson, Beauregard, Sessions, our attorney general start talking about this state rights. It's hypocrisy, but they're doing it as code words, and that's, we'll get to that further in the conversation. But think about the history of police in America, the slave patrol, and the Fugitive Slave Act. And all these things that they created just to control people of color in America. And then you fast forward where we have this Great Civil War. And After the Civil War, they had Reconstruction where they passed the so-called Civil Rights Acts, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. The 13th Amendment freed the slaves. The 14th Amendment gave us equal protection and due process of the law. And the 15th Amendment gave blacks and everybody, all men, the right to vote. Women, y'all didn't come around to the 21st Amendment. So these Civil Rights Amendments, within 10 years of the passage of the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment, the United States of the Supreme Court effectively nullified all of those amendments. They passed laws that made them almost ineffective. Because think about it, you had the slave codes that were passed after the 13th Amendment that freed the slaves. And so for an example, they would have black people who were free now, off the plantation, they would pass all these anti-vagrancy laws that said that if you were walking down the street, the police had a right to say, hey, where are you going? Do you have a job? And if you said, I don't have a job, I'm not going any particular where, well, that was a crime. It's the law of vagrancy. I was getting to that. You already been cheating on my notes. But literally, that is what became stop and frisk today. The past is prologue. The 14th Amendment, all this stuff about due process and equal protection, and U.S. v. Cruikshank, they massacred over 150 black people after they had the election down in Louisiana, where these newly freed black people, black men voted black people into power, and they voted a Democratic governor into power in the state of Louisiana. I see some heads shaking. Y'all heard of this case. In that case, one of the worst massacres of black people ever, when they were in the courthouse trying to establish who was going to get the authority to represent the government in the Democratic election, the white KKK and white supremacists came with their guns and murdered men, women, and children. The Supreme Court did what happened. The federal government came, because you know this is fresh after Reconstruction, and they're still saying, hey, the North, we got to protect these black people because we know these KKK and these white knights are trying to intimidate them. So the court came, and they got three of the leaders, Cruikshank being one of them, and they convicted him of the crime of murder and manslaughter. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, less than 10 years after the 14th Amendment was passed, ruled that the federal government only had authority that was granted by the Constitution specifically. Anything that's not granted by the Constitution specifically goes back to the 10th Amendment and states' rights. So essentially, what they said was the only protection black people could expect from the KKK and the white supremacists were going to be the state leaders of that state. Now, the state leaders of the state of Louisiana is the KKK. And so, literally, it was open season from that time in 1860 all the way up to like the 1945 for them to just kill and do whatever they want to intimidate black people. And then the last thing on the voters' rights. Everybody got the right to vote. Well, the 15th Amendment, they then said everybody got the right to vote. However, states' rights again, the states could pass laws to say arbitrary things like, if your grandfather could not vote, then you can't vote. Well, damn. Well, black people's grandfather could vote before the 15th Amendment and the Civil War. And then the poll tax. And then all this stuff about you had to be able to recite the U.S. Constitution verbatim to vote. And so they did all these things. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, hey, again, if it is not specifically given by the authority in the language of the Constitution, the federal government can't do anything. It all goes back to states' rights. So you have this perpetuation of discrimination from founding of the country to Reconstruction, and then right up until now, in 1945, and Chris was a police officer before he became an attorney, so he we talk a lot. He give me a different perspective. I still challenge him on everything. But and it's interesting to know some of the psychology behind how police officers think. And my little brother is a police officer, so I always tell people it's not that we're against police officers, we're against bad police officers who kill us and brutalize us and those type of things. But in 1945 was the first time in the United States of America where the Supreme Court of the United States spoke on police brutality. It was a case called U.S. v. Screws. Screws, a young black man, sheriff, and his two deputies beat the hell out of him, killed him right there in Courthouse Square in a small town, Georgia. If the federal government, the Justice Department convicted the sheriff, they found him guilty, and he was in jail. They appealed it. It went up to the Supreme Court. Now, while he was in jail, ironically, he got reelected sheriff. you know what we're dealing with. This is the South, and I will say, normally when I use the South, shock, I'm using Malcolm X's definition of the South, anything below the Canadian border. But in this particular case, the Supreme Court ruled that the Department of Justice and the federal government had no right to do anything if he was going to be convicted. The state of Georgia and the state attorney would have to do it, just like with Michael Brown, just like with Eric Garner, just like with Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, Stokely, Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, and the list goes on and on. If the local prosecutor isn't going to do anything, the Supreme Court has said that the federal government is going to be prohibited to do anything, and that's still the system today. But what is particularly important in that particular case is they said that even though there's all the objective evidence in the world to contradict what the sheriff said, the sheriff claimed he felt that the young black man was reaching for his gun. And because he was reaching for his gun, allegedly, he felt in fear of his life. And anytime a police officer say they feel in fear of their life, that's the magic word. All they got to do is say the F word. And if they do that, then they just, they sanitize the killing of black and brown people anytime a police officer say, I felt in fear of my life. And it don't matter what evidence you have. Hell, we got videotape now. But as long as the police officer say, Terrence Crutcher, we were there in Tulsa, Oklahoma, he walking away in broad daylight with his hands up. The white police woman shoot him. She got two officers with her, a helicopter overhead, and she say she felt, y'all saw the video. I mean, it was on video. And she said, I felt in fear of my life. And that was it. Everybody say, well, hey, if you said you can fear for life of a big black man, then the killing is justified. They said that in 1945, it has been made precedence again in Graham v. Conner. Also in Kentucky, the Supreme Court says over and over again, we are not allowed as a society to question the police. And that's problematic. So when we talk about fighting in the courtroom, this is a social justice initiative. It won't be one sold in the courtroom because the courtroom is the people who are perpetuating the discrimination. If it's going to change, it's going to be because people in our community make sure that our children are going to be more intelligent than their oppressors. It's as simple as that. We got to be smarter than them. We're never going to stop the prison industrial complex. We're never going to stop this killing of our children. We're never going to stop this taking our voting away unless we educate ourselves as to the system that exists, this system of legalization of discrimination. I cannot say it over and over and over again. If you remember nothing else I say today, remember that there's a system of legalization of discrimination in America that we must overcome if we are to ever have a chance of giving our children the equal rights to the American dream that the Constitution says.
And you know, Adam, that is that is within the court, what I've heard you say, but also the actions that people who are not lawyers, who are not in the courtroom, that we take in the churches and the synagogues and out of the street, also very important to fighting cases. Because I know, you know, not everybody has that view.
I think everybody can do something. I think Susan Burton is probably one of the best examples I've seen. You're never going to change it within the system. You figure out what you can do. And everybody can do something. Martin Luther King said that we, as moral-minded people, have a moral obligation to do something and oppose injustice when we see it. He said, if we're going to say we're moral people, we have to do something. I mean, he said that in that letter from the Birmingham jail. And he said, you know, just because they say it's legal, that don't make it right. You know, everything Hitler did to the Jews in Germany was legal, but that didn't make it right. You know, slavery and segregation was legal, but that don't make it right. So just because they tell us something's legal, and I mean, you know, Eric Garner here in Los Angeles, Alicia Thomas, that sister was killed for taking her children and dropping them off at the police station. And they came to her apartment and said she abandoned her children. And really, she was operating within the law, the safe haven law, where she didn't want to drop her children off in the alleyway. She at least did a responsible thing, knowing that she had some mental challenges. She went and dropped them off at the little boy, her 12-year-old son, with his grandmother's phone number in the pocket, and her 3-year-old daughter. But they came and arrested her, and what happened to her was on videotape. And I say all that to say this here. These police officers in the court system, they try real hard, intellectually justified with these secret grand jury proceedings. You know, we all saw it on the video, but then they go back in this room and they talk and they do stuff, and then they come out, Chris, and they say, well, what you all saw on the video was not a violation of policy. They didn't technically break any rules or regulations, and they come out and say, well, we can't charge them. Well, Lyles, you know, that ain't right, but they have made it legal, but that ain't right, and we know that. And we have to say something about it. We have to go down to the courthouse when we have to sit during the trial. One of the saddest things to do is to go in the courtroom and the only thing black is you, your client, and the judge's robe. I mean, that is a shame. So y'all, we gotta serve on jury duty. When we get those jury notices, we gotta go down to that courtroom, because just one person in that room changes the whole conversation. You may understand the life experiences of that person, and you can say something to the other people on the jury who come from different communities. You can say, well, you know, the police was stopping and frisking him. They had no probable cause, so really, this is wrong. And that one person that's speaking up makes a world of difference. Now, I got to say this, and this is just a pet peeve of mine because I'm pissed about it. Terrence Crutcher's case, the one I just told you about, hands up, walking away, two African Americans on the jury, 10 whites. They go out there for 8 hours. They come back, they return the verdict, they say not guilty. People pissed, people upset, protests in the street. Anonymously, they write a letter to the court saying, we don't think she should ever be a police officer again, all this stuff. But then 2 days later, one of the black people on the jury says that, well, we were tired, we were hungry, and it's just, we didn't know how long it was gonna take, so we just gave in. Now, juxtapose that.
Outrageous.
Juxtapose that, well, 2 months earlier, they were trying a white police officer who was off duty in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and shot this 18-year-old black boy who was dating his 16-year-old daughter. Shot him in cold blood. This is the second trial. You got two blacks on that jury and 10 whites. 11 people on the jury all want to convict this guy. They say he's guilty as hell. He's talking about it was self-defense. Even his family isn't backing him on the self-defense. There's one young white boy on there, one young white boy, who says that I don't care what you say, I'm not going to convict that white man for killing that Negro. He stayed, kept the jury out for 49 hours. So they had to declare a mistrial and try it all over again. Now think about Terrence Crutcher's case on video. If those black people would have had the fortitude to say, hey man, I don't care how long this takes, I'm not going to let this lady get away with murder. That's the conviction we got to have. But somehow, we always give in back there. This is your one time to have your vote really, really, really count. You one of six people or one of 12 people in a courtroom, and if you don't want to change your vote, you ain't got to change your vote. You just say, I'm voting that that black person don't go to jail, and you ain't got to explain nothing to them. They don't explain nothing to you. Your vote is your vote. People die for that vote. And so you got to go in that jury room when you get an opportunity to serve. And you got to serve, y'all. We need you. Not just the black lawyers, but our black children need you. Man, I mean, it's like I said, the worst killings, way worse than Trayvon and them, is where how they do every day to hundreds of our children. How they have these trumped up charges. And we then get these felony convictions that we have to bear on our back forever, Ms. Darcell. And you can never get away from it these days in America with the information age. No matter what, they look on that computer and say, oh, when you was 19 years old, you stole a pack of nylon ladies. Yeah.
Well, let me ask this. I mean, your point is well taken. I remember hearing Harry Belafonte at the 50th anniversary conference of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, really going on a rant and talking about how we've lost our moral center and about people getting too soft. Okay? And I think that's part of what you were referring to. And I think, you know, I do a lot of work on with the grassroots folks on the ground in Haiti, the most impoverished place in the Western Hemisphere. I think of a place like City Soleil, I can't even describe it. It's indescribable,
yes,
the level of poverty there,
absolutely,
right? And I see the determination of the people that they intend to complete their revolution that they started 200 years ago, and they're not going to be beat down. Then they beat down, they get up again.
Yes.
And about your point about people talking about they were tired and hungry, but it also brings us to the point.
Let me just tell you. Yeah, I got to remember, Haiti is the only country in the Northern Hemisphere that has never been ruled by white people. And I think there's a reason why Haiti is being punished by the world. They have never let the white people rule them as a country. And America and everybody else has treated them like they're the worst thing in the world. And I believe when you study their history, there's a reason for that.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons that on the show, and just generally, I think it's so important for those of us living in this country, you know, not just to just think about what is in front of our face, but also look to a place like Haiti. Look to where our brothers and sisters are in serious struggle, and if you think we're facing poverty and we're catching hell, you can bet somebody else is catching even more hell. So if we go sit on a jury, we're not going to complain about being tired and hungry when you got sisters in Africa on the continent walking with their children and no food for 3 days just to get to a meeting so that they can figure out how they're going to get out from under. I mean, that's the kind of moral center that I think that we all have to have.
You're listening to my interview with Benjamin L. Crump, attorney for the families of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and others whose children were killed by police. We're going to take a short station break, and when we return, we'll bring you more from my conversation with Benjamin Crump, which took place as one of the plenary sessions at the 2017 Justice on Trial Film Festival. Thank you.
sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever...
And that song was Redemption Song by the late, great Bob Marley. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 a.m. and for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth, and you'll be able to listen to this show in its entirety. You can also listen to all of our back shows on our website at sotrueradio.org. You can also like and friend us on Facebook if you're a member. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And we're available on SoundCloud. And today I'd like to give a shout out to all of our SoundCloud listeners who are incarcerated in prisons across the United States. We now return to my conversation with Benjamin L. Crump, attorney for the families of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and others whose sons were killed by police. It was recorded on September 17, 2017, as part of the Justice on Trial Film Festival held at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. Let's return now to that recording.
The whole issue then of the effectiveness of the legal system. We see you out there all the time. We see case after case after case. We see them shooting down practically every day, it seems. Not only young black women and men, but you also have the case of Anthony, was it Anthony Montez?
Young
Latino, brother, immigrant, right, in Washington State. Indigenous people don't even talk about indigenous people. They talk like, we don't even need to mention them. Yeah. You know, we don't even need to include them in any data. But on the effectiveness of the legal system, really wanted to get your view on that. Because we see cop after cop after cop getting off. Yeah. And that a lot of times, we're in a situation where we say, okay, we want the Department of Justice to come and investigate. And this was when Obama was in there. This wasn't even when Jefferson the racist Sessions is in there. And Trump and his boys in the White House. And a lot of us are in this, I mean, we're in this situation now dealing with the serial murders of black women in South LA that went on for decades. By the way, I just found out a few weeks ago that in the same period of time, there were 500 black women whose bodies were found, okay? So this is not a finished story. I'm not saying all of them were victims of serial murder. It's likely about 200, but still, that's a lot. And we're in a situation now where we're like, well, do we say we want an investigation by the Department of Justice and the LAPD that allowed this crap to happen? Because where is that going to take us right now? You know, it's just a serious question that I know you thought about, and all of us here are thinking about if we're involved in some kind of movement. You know what I mean? Like, what do we do?
I think the solution is never going to come from the government. Because they're going to continue to try to maintain the status quo. They're going to try to continue to elevate law enforcement officers because they keep the status quo. And they're going to always elevate this precedence, these laws that were passed back in the 1700s and 1800s that forms precedence. And it's kind of like a vicious game. When you think about it, this precedence, everything in the court, they teach us all in law school that you have to follow precedence. Well, if we follow precedence, they say I should still be a slave. You know, that's precedence. And I think you have to remember the mentality. We'll get to due process in a second about in the court, in the laws, but the bigger issues are societal. I think Attorney O'Neill and I was talking about with these Confederate statues, it's one of the only things in the world. I mean, it's so ironic that you have people who want to celebrate the ideals of the losing side. You know, they want to celebrate what the losing side thought was the right thing to do. And it has been universally rejected, this white supremacy. But yet, they keep trying to celebrate it. I think the funny analogy, Chris, was the one about, this is like in New England, them wanting to celebrate the Atlanta Falcons who lost the Super Bowl last year. You know, building a statue of their quarterback, Matt Ryan. He's the loser. He let them come back. But that's what we're doing when we got all these Confederate generals up that we keep wanting to, you know, say they were the greatest thing since sliced bread. And so it's this mentality. So I think it's in society. Lolita Files and I, we talk about this a lot in the writing, and we're working on this this Who Killed Tupac docuseries for A&E, and it talked about due process of the law a lot. Remember, due process of the law is simply the fair administration of justice. That is, whatever you do for one party, you're supposed to do it for the other party. It doesn't matter how rich they are, how poor they are, if they're a corporation, if they're a government agency, if they're a regular citizen. Due process of the law is this catch-all phrase of the 14th Amendment that says it has to be fair. And what we see in America is we hardly never get due process of the law. It is one of those situations where it doesn't matter that Tupac was one of the most well-known rappers in the world, one of the most famous individuals in the world, he was still a young black man. And due process doesn't start when we get to the courtroom. Due process starts on the street level with the police gathering the evidence. That's due process of the law, making sure you give a fair investigation, that you give the right stuff to the prosecutor to bring the charges, that the prosecutor do whatever he would do to little Junebug and little Shaniqua, that he's gonna do it to little Becky and little Billy. That's what we call due process of the law in layman's terms. So you fast forward that and you think about this concept of it's not happening in the courts. So how can we change it in society? I believe we have to attack it, and that's why I'm doing a lot of this stuff in TV these days, because I'm starting to think law and order controls how a lot of people think in the courtroom. I mean, TV, Malcolm X said it best, TV is one of the most powerful drugs ever created. I mean, it can affect how you think, and you don't even know that you thinking this crap. It's in your subconscious. So, you know, law and order and forensic files, all this stuff, the cop is always right, and the definition of justice is to lock them up and throw away the key. I'm doing this television series for TV1 called Evidence of Innocence, about wrongfully incarcerated individuals that have been exonerated by clear and convincing evidence and DNA evidence, mostly black and Hispanic people. No surprise there, right? And so it is believed by the Innocence Project that there are over 100,000 people sitting in prison in America who are completely innocent. I mean, completely innocent. Just happen to be at the wrong place, the wrong time, and the wrong race. That's the only crime that they can get on them. And so we have to keep putting this in their head that the police wasn't always right. We got to have this on TV showing that. Hold on. When you're in that courtroom, I want you to think about the episode of Evidence of Innocence and don't be so quick to convict, because right now, law and order, you know, I'm a cynic. I you get jaded after a while. You be like, damn, the police and the prosecutor always right. The little black people was always wrong. Because that's what they put in your head if you watch it. But we got to say, hold on, that's their story. We got to tell our story. We know our people and we know their character. And think about this. 7% of America are black men. How is it that black men can make up almost 50% of death row. Either you got to conclude one or two things. You got to conclude that black men are just some terrible, evil, nefarious human beings, one, or two, this system is broken. I choose to believe all us black men ain't bad as they say we are, that this system is broken.
The fastest growing population of people being incarcerated now are single mothers.
Yep.
They're women. Now that means the numbers of women are still less, numbers wise, than the men going to prison. But we really have to look at that in terms of why that is happening. And the vast majority of those women are single mothers. So what's happening to the children? Getting snatched up by the Department of the DCFS and the Child Welfare Agencies, farming them out, putting it's like a new slave, auction block for little black and brown babies, right? Where after 6 months, the fast track adoption, after you in prison, they can put your child up for adoption. If you don't meet all the criteria, guidelines, and everything else, that's it. You lose your parental rights. And with immigrant women, you got immigrant children now with their mothers down in Mexico somewhere with some racist adopted families that aren't even letting them talk by telephone to their mamas. So, you know, we got to focus also on what's happening with the women. And Sandra Bland, what happened to her? There are a lot of Sandra Bland.
Yes.
There are a lot of these sisters that this stuff is happening to. But I wonder what I hear you saying in response to the question that I asked about Department of Justice and fighting in the courtroom, but yet we see them winning again and again and again. We know what our marching orders are. We got to get on the juries. We got to support our black and brown attorneys that are out there trying to do the right thing.
You have to make a record no matter what, so you can provide the historical evidence, the historical data. And I don't want to say it's just black and brown attorneys. It's a lot of good white attorneys who I work with who are fighting harder than some of us. It's moral-minded people. People who say we're going to choose to be good over being evil because it's a choice. I was listening to Martin Luther King's speech, we were there filming in Atlanta, and it was interesting to me. Dr. King said, we cannot let them say that when we are protesting for civil rights and for human rights and social justice, that that's the same as the white supremacists and the KKK and them out marching. Because that's what they often try to do. They try to intellectually justify, well, both of y'all are marching for things that y'all say are important to your people. That's how they kind of try to couch it. Dr. King got real philosophical. He said, well, if you allow that argument to prevail, then what you're really saying that God is not real, that good does not trump evil. And he said, we can't let that argument win. So we got to reject this notion that the white supremacists who are out there protesting are doing the noble thing that the highest lady, they have the highest who died in Charlottesville. I mean, that, and you know, no matter what we thought of what President Trump was trying to say, which everybody attacked, but they try to say that in courtrooms every day. I mean, they try to say that, hold on, the KKK is doing nothing more than what Black Lives Matter are doing. And I keep scratching my head and I say, hold on, Black Lives Matter marching and saying, quit killing us. They're not marching to say that one race is superior to another. How do you equalize that and say they're the same? They are not the same. And we have to not let them advance that argument. We have to stand up and document it. Our associate, you would ask them what the marching orders are? Yeah, the marching orders, you all don't have to be lawyers. Our educators, our professors, our historians, our psychologists, we got to start writing and documenting stuff. It is amazing to me when you write stuff in a publication or a journal, how much respect people give it. Lolita Files, you got to keep writing books. I mean, the authors got to be writing about this stuff, because if you don't write about it, nobody, if it's just lip service, that's what they call it, lip service. We have to document it over and over again. We have to get it published. I don't care if it's just our magazines, whether it be our black colleges or what. It needs to be somebody writing something down saying, this is not the more equivalence of Black Lives Matter, KKK. It is not the more equivalence talking about exonerating George Zimmerman for killing Trayvon Martin and convicting the Somalian police officer in Minneapolis for killing the white officer. Now, the funny thing, and Susan, I know time is getting short, but I gotta say this. We get a chance to speak truth to power, and I know y'all powerful people. Y'all more powerful than y'all even know it. And so I'm gonna speak truth to power. Think about all these police unions. I mean, every case I got, every case you ever seen, whether it's Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, Sandra Bland, the police unions jumped quickly to the aid of the white police officers, even in that Stokely case. I mean, they marched, they rallied, they raised money, they do everything. Now, in Minneapolis, when the Somalian officer killed the white lady, I mean, you ain't heard nothing from the police. I mean, you haven't heard a word from him. And I'm not saying that it's right that he should be able to get away with it, but
right.
The NRA, when you think about our client, Corey Jones in West Palm Beach, Florida, Shaka, when this kid, he was a church drummer, broke down on the side of the road on I-95. He's on the phone with the tow truck company. The undercover police officer come and kill him, and it had not been for that tow truck recording, then he would have got away with it. Jonathan Wallace and Charlotte got an accident. They killed him. And these people had guns, but they had permits to carry them. The NRA hasn't said anything about them, about Philando Castile, you know, who said, told the officer, I got a gun in the glove compartment. I want to tell you this because I don't want you to shoot me when you see it. And what did the officer do? He shot him. And the NRA crickets. They didn't say anything about it. So we got to call this out. We got to write about it and document it. Because if we don't, it goes on as if it didn't exist. It didn't happen. And so we got to tell our story. We got to document our story, because we got to make sure our children are more intelligent than their oppressors.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank Susan Burton, A New Way of Life Reentry Project, and the entire team of the Justice on Trial Film Festival for hosting this event with Benjamin Crump. I'd also like to thank our longtime intern, Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, and our engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Stay tuned for Rising Up. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening.